I think if we go back to the roots of what Jesus did, what he said, and how he lived, and try to get in touch with what is he really calling people to follow him as? Because I think as disciples, we're called to follow a teacher, a master, a guru, someone who's leading us on a journey, and we're to follow that person on the journey. That's the idea. And in the first session, we talked a little bit that so many people never reach a mature discipleship or a mature spirituality. And we looked at Scott Peck's analysis of the patterns of transformation. How do people reach a higher level of what he calls spiritual maturity? And we said many people get stymied at what he calls level two. He says the majority of people in the churches, it's not a mature spirituality. Some people are able, because they're simply not satisfied with that, they press on to what he calls level four spirituality. And my tack in these sessions has been that the way we can break beyond our level two-ness to more spirituality is not the usual way that we attempt to do it in the churches. Usually we try to tell people, we've got to learn to love more, or we need to pray more, or we need to worship more, we need to study the Bible, we need to do many things that seem to be, quote, more spiritual. But in my experience as a pastor, I believe that people get stymied because they remove spirituality from the realm of real life. And I suggested that the way to get to that deeper spirituality, to going to a more authentic discipleship, is to rally around great themes that I think Jesus himself was committed to and calls us to follow. And I said those themes are, one, to live in solidarity with the poor. That is, as much as possible, regardless of my state in life, to to make a commitment to live with, on behalf of the poor. We have two options. One is to do what Jesus told the rich young ruler. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. That's one solution. And I think that those that do it, that's a good solution. Most of us don't follow that solution, and I think that can be okay. But if we're not going to sell all we have, if we're going to continue our, for most of us, rather middle, we're pretty middle class. As Americans, we're surely pretty well off. We've got to figure out, then what does it mean to live in solidarity with the poor? And I believe it is possible to drive a nice car, maybe even a second car in the family. I believe it's possible to live in a pretty nice home, go out to dinner, once in a while, more extravagantly than you need to. I do live that way. But at the same time, to make commitments that are lived in conjunction and for the poor. We didn't explore that in a lot of detail, and we may want to talk about that a little bit tonight. What are some ways of doing that? The second night, what did I talk about?
Is this a quiz?
The what?
Is this a quiz?
No.
You better not be, because... I have no idea. The third night, or third afternoon, we talked about being peacemakers and living non-violently. And we basically said, it's not thinking peace would be a great thing, not wanting peace, saying we ought to have peace, but rather to be an active peacemaker. And then we looked at violence and non-violence. We were saying that we looked at the different levels of violence, personal violence, institutional violence, overt violence that is outward, and covert violence inward. You know, the difference between overt being killing somebody, covert being psychological, you know, telling a person they're no good. Eventually they'll come to believe they're no good when they internalize that. Why am I? I'm not thinking today.
You're doing fine.
I'll skip it. Just go on. Just do the peace and the court.
That's good. At the forum last night.
Forum is.
You're talking about the solidarity with the poor and this kind of thing. And let me raise this question and see how we deal with it. One Valdez picks coffee for $2 a day, okay, and we buy coffee here. What can we do to help Juan Valdez? I mean, how does it get from here to there? How do we have that kind of solidarity that makes a difference in his life?
Okay, good.
And I don't know. That's why I raised the question. I wanted to raise it last night, but we ran out of time.
Okay, well now, by the way, I told the group that I'm not going to present new material tonight. I had planned to. I was going to talk about seeking justice tonight, and I may just say a few things about that, but I've been throwing out so many ideas. I thought we ought to get down to where we all talk more tonight. And so anybody that wanted to go to a different class, you're welcome to. I will not give you a lot of surprisingly new, tremendous ideas tonight. So if you wish, you can be excused. Secondly, if you're not, I'm going to make you guys pull in a little bit, and would you just bring your chairs up a little bit? Because first of all, I'm a little hard of hearing, and when you contribute, I do not hear you often, but you're okay there, I think, just the ends. You can get up the front.
I'm right where I belong, believe me. Right behind my wife.
Okay, well. Okay, well, let's talk about that a little bit. If we're to live in...
I just wanted to make a comment that Juan Valdez, getting the $2 a day 10 years ago, is still getting $2 a day now. While the coffee prices have tripled in this country in the last 12 years. So that this over the years, there's more of a disparity and more of a disparity all the time.
Okay, how do we live in solidarity with the poor? We're going to struggle with a situation here. Juan gets $2 a day cultivating coffee. I assume he's down in Guatemala or Salvador.
Somewhere.
But let's say he might even be a farm worker here in Washington or California or someplace. We drink a lot of coffee, you're saying.
I don't, but that...
Many of us do.
Yeah.
You drink tea. So. Yeah. And I can tell you about Tanzania, where they get $1 a day, those people who work in the tea fields.
That's good tea.
Yeah, it's good tea.
But
they still only get $1 a day. So, what does it mean for us if we're living in solidarity with the poor? How do we relate that to Juan's situation? Let's play with that a little bit.
Well, if we stop drinking coffee, that won't help him, I don't believe.
The companies that the intermediaries that produce the ones that export the coffee, big coffee companies, Maxwell, et cetera, they're big corporations. A lot of us have stock in those corporations, and we could do something in stockholders' meetings or by writing letters. That's one way, perhaps, of getting them to be more humanitarian in their management policies. because the United States industries control the situation. I mean, and they're making money all the time, increasingly every year, making more money, which goes to stockholders, of which some of us are probably shareholders, but it's largely the fault of our American big corporations, American economic system. But what we do about it, I don't know, except to do as they say, get up a stockholders meetings or write letters to CEO or whatever.
Does everybody understand the problem we're dealing with? I'd like just to do some framework here. What are some possible suggestions?
What do you mean by solidarity with the poor? What do you mean by living in solidarity with the poor?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. But it means to stand to, in everything I do, to ask the question, what can my presence and my actions do to help benefit the poor? Instead of being part of the problem, to be part of the solution. Maybe that would be.
And everywhere here in America.
Here in America, in other countries, wherever. Obviously, you know, there's the immediate context where we live.
That's a big problem.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the middle class has it too well. I think the middle class is very well off, and I don't think we help the poor enough. Myself, I'm guilty.
So one option would be the willingness to surrender some of the privilege that we enjoy. And I think that's very much, that's tough. People don't do that willingly, and it's not too realistic, but I think the present tax plan that's being proposed and tentatively has been adopted says everyone is going to have to pay something if we're going to have the underprivileged a little better off. And of course, it's kind of nice if we can say, and those that in the last 12 years, 10 years, have benefited unusually well, have disproportionately been favored by the tax system, that they should pay a much higher rate. I believe in that. It's amazing, most of my friends, or people that I know, agree with this, except I'm a retired person. I'm paying Social Security. And I'm finding most people on Social Security say, but you shouldn't touch elderly people receiving Social Security.
That's right.
And people who are at every other level, we all want to be the exception to paying the price.
We are all very selfish.
Yeah.
And so where do we start? Where do we start to change? Because if the young people who are young now, if they're not going to have opportunity, we're not going to get our Social Security checks in 10 years from now.
Yeah, so where do we start? So right now we want 20 different things that we can do to help Juan and Joe and Mary.
Well, maybe we need to get involved in the political situation so that we can give some pressure to our congressmen to represent us and know that not all of us are selfish. Well, I guess we all are selfish, but we're not all saying, I don't want to get hurt in the next tax thing. I think this is going to all come up when the medical program comes out.
Get directly involved with those who represent us and let them know that there's some pressure from us that all of us are willing to pay something towards this. By the way, as a pastor, I found there was always pressure on me anytime I talked about any social action matter.
war. The second session was on militarism, sure. Anytime I said something about the Gulf War or anything like that, I had all the people that, you know, worked in defense plants, all the military-related people, a lot of rather conservative people, that's America, right or wrong, they all jumped on me, put pressure on me. And one of the good things we did, we created a social action committee, and it wasn't all that large, but it probably touched 10% of the congregation. And when I didn't speak on things like that, they jumped on me. They said, "What are you going to sound off about all the, you know, evils in our society?" And I think a congregation needs to have pressure from the left as well as the right, or from the liberal or radical fringe as well as from the conservative fringe. Pressure is, we respond to it. And Congress is the same way, our representatives, our state legislators. Okay, so getting involved that politically.
I was going to say that I remember 40-some years ago, I was taught that one of the wonderful things about the United States was that we had a progressive tax system. We had a progressive income tax, and we've lost that now. And people really don't seem to think about that. But I think that I always try to remind people of the idea that, remember when, you know, we learned that the progressive income tax was a good system? Why don't we think back on those times?
Does anybody remember... Are any of you of an age where you remember? What was the highest percentage of income tax, say, 1940, 50?
I thought it was as high as 90% or something like that, wasn't it, at one time? It was tremendously high.
That's right, it was 90%, it was 70%. Is that correct? I'm sure that's correct. And, of course, that may be a very extreme thing, but interestingly, those were some of the years that, as that America made the most gigantic strides in productivity and became, in a sense, the world power.
Mm-hmm. I think the tax structure was simple enough in those days, too, and there was less attempts to avoid paying tax to the extent that it was possible for people, you know, if you wouldn't jump into the next tax bracket and actually have a less income than if you were in the next lower income tax bracket, but there was a more straightforward taxation system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
it
was really valuable.
Okay. We're asking, how can we live in solidarity with the poor? We brought up the example, Juan works in a coffee plantation, he gets $2 a day. Many of us drink coffee. What's the connection? How can we work and live in solidarity with the poor and do something about Juan's situation? That was the proposal. We're exploring some ways, some others.
One of the obvious ways is giving a larger percent of our income to those organizations that work for justice with poor. I don't have all the smarts to do precisely what needs to be done because I'm engaged in making money, in a sense. I do not have the time to listen as effectively as I should to those who need specific kinds of help. And so maybe what I should be doing is making sure that a substantial portion of my income goes to those who are engaged in that and able to do the kind of things that need to be done to really live in solidarity with the poor, while I don't have to do it on a personal basis by going down and feeding somebody who's homeless. But I can take a tenth or more of my income and see that that gets done by reasonable, responsible organizations.
Okay. There are a lot of great organizations that are not some of them little small ones that are very efficient and effective. Third World Handcrafts. Third World Hand Arts, I think it's called down in Southern California. They market the products from many of the third world countries. And they bring it in and they make arrangements for selling it with, so that all the profits go back to those handcraft places back in Peru or Guatemala or Tanzania or wherever it might have come from. And that's one way. By the way, there are places you can buy Colombian and and Guatemalan coffee that Juan picks that doesn't go through the big coffee franchises, and they get a much bigger percentage, of course, of the profits out of that.
Never heard of, where's that? Never heard of that. Where do you?
Well, I don't know. In Southern California, there's just many places that handle
direct without a middleman.
Yeah. And you know, they're one of the big stores down south. Is it Nordstrom's? In their coffee shop, they offer it. It costs more. It's better coffee, by the way, because it's not diluted with all kinds of mixtures.
That's an oxymoron.
Is there any listing of some of these smaller groups that are authentic and responsible? Like you mentioned, the handcraft. Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody that's put together any type of a list?
I'm sure if you look at Sojourner magazine, you would find a number of them listed almost every time. That would be one way.
I think the Mennonites have a catalog of third world handcrafts and coffees in there too.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
I forget, I'm trying to think of the name of the catalog.
Would somebody see if they look in our resource center here and see if there's something available right here and have it tomorrow? This group meets at 11:30 tomorrow. Anybody be willing to try to track that down? Would you do that? And I'm sure there's some, in some of the magazines or catalogs, there's something in that order. Okay. What are some other ways?
If we're brainstorming here, and if we really want, there's two things I can think of. And one is education, because I don't think people truly understand what our relationship is with Juan de Valdez in terms of what the political policy or what the economics of the situation is. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm doing that. And the other thing I think is the almost massive exchange of our children with other countries. I don't want to send my child to Guatemala. I don't have children that age, but I wouldn't want to send them to Guatemala at this point because I think it would be dangerous. But I think that the more of our children that go out of this country to another country and experience another way of looking at things, and then having those children come back to our country and seeing what it's like here helps us all to understand and I think develop a much greater appreciation for other ways of
absolutely
life. And those are two things I can do.
Along that line, in any of the larger cities, there are places to contact for people from some of those countries. You know, Central America, for instance. Bring them to your church. Let them tell you their experiences. There's nothing as convincing as to get our congregation was part of the sanctuary movement, and we try to bring them every so often, and let them report on why did they leave Guatemala? Why did they leave Salvador? Why did they leave Honduras? And then what's their experiences? What's happened since they got here? And when people listen to those stories, they usually start becoming much more sympathetic. The AFL-CIO has certain organizers that go down to places like El Salvador and try to organize the tobacco farmers and workers, and so that there's some pressure from the workers themselves for more better wages, better working conditions, and so on, so that they can learn some of the techniques of organizing for their own interests, and of course. A number of them have been killed because they're not very popular with the governments that have a vested interest in keeping things in the status quo. So that it's a very dangerous thing. But somehow they have to be helped to seek out better conditions. And of course in this country, I believe many farm worker organizations do the same thing. And there again, invite some people from the farm worker ministry, for instance, to come to your church. What are they doing? And to understand the problem of the farm worker in this country. They don't work for $2 a day. They work for $3 or $4 an hour often. Supposedly there's minimum wages. Supposedly some of them are doing much better. But the reality is, especially in California, I know, many farm workers are working that don't average even $5 an hour.
You know, I don't think you can effectively lift the status of those societies unless we can deal with some of the basic issues, such as their uncontrolled population growth. And I don't think that will be controlled until there's a change in the attitude on the part of institutions such as the Catholic Church, and also until the status of women is dramatically upgraded. As long as women have the extremely low status that they have in other third world countries, whether they're in the Asian countries or in the African countries, you're still going to end up with this incredible population growth, the high fertility rate, the large families, the poverty, the low average age in the country. Some of these countries, the average age of the people are 14 years old of the entire population because of the burgeoning youth. And unless there can be, through organizations such as the UN and things that can really bring family planning to those countries, there is absolutely no hope. And time has run out. All of the predictions that, you know, people beginning with Malthus have made are coming true all over the world. And, you know, unless the world can deal with the population issue, and I don't think we can. I think it's too late. You know, it's
well,
a pretty...
Well, now I'm getting pessimistic, because until we can do this, we can't do anything, but I don't think we can. Yeah.
But, you know, attitudes change so slowly in these very established societies that, you know, we're Americans, we're used to seeing, you know, change, you know, we want it now, and we're very whimsical. But a lot of these societies, I mean, they're hundreds and thousands of years old, whereas ours is a very recent culture, so it's problematic to change them. But unless there can be, you know, real substantial advances made in controlling the population and, you know, raising the status of women in those societies, there's no hope.
Well, you're surely right. All these problems are so interconnected that one doesn't happen without the other. But when we were talking about peacemaking, one of the things I said is that as a peacemaker, as difficult as it is, we believe it is possible. It's awfully easy to start thinking it's not possible, but you've got to go believing it is possible. I personally believe there's no problem that is not finally something we can manage. Population, oh yeah, it's just going crazy. And nothing's going to change until working conditions are better, to women, especially women, have a more substantial place in those countries. But education has to take place. The exploitative policies of first world countries, United States, Europe, Japan, and trade investments have got to be changed. All these things have to happen. The encouraging thing is that if little groups of people here and there are active in seeking a more just world, some things happen. Good things happen. And I think there are all kinds of good things happening. Sometimes I get really discouraged because I think there's all kinds of terrible things happening too. At this level, but you just persist, you persist, you persist.
I was going to finish.
I'm just going to throw out a bit of encouragement. I did some research this spring on population growth in third world countries. And in fact, there are many countries in Southeast Asia that are in implementing very very intense family planning.
I can't hear you.
What haven't you heard?
Or just the last part?
They've been implemented very intense family planning programs, and in Indonesia in particular, in the last 15 years, the percentage of people that have used family birth control has gone from about 16% up to 90% in the last 15 years.
Good.
So, and then the countries over there, they see it's almost like, you know, the United States, the other states doing things, and then they start these programs. And Thailand and the Philippines is more of a problem because, as you mentioned, the Catholic population. But that's not the only, the religious views aren't the only problems. That, since infant mortality is so high, they have this, the families have this idea of continuing, so they have more children. And a lot of it is more of a health issue than a religious issue. And so a lot of the way that it's being implemented is through a lot of healthcare organizations and medical organizations, not necessarily from Western countries, but from within their own, when they recognize that they're, I mean, it's ironic that the population is growing at the rate that it is, and at the same time the infant mortality are the highest, you know, than anywhere else in the world. But
if I'm going to have any kind of Social Security in my old age, if it is not provided by my country or by my wages, I better have about 15 kids to survive to take care of me.
Right. But and then when the children are healthier, and when they there are educational programs and just like the health, how it's healthier to be breastfeeding, and concerns regarding diarrhea, which is the number one cause of children's death in third world countries, or one of them, number one and number two. And very easily remedied, and there's a lot of education going on right now. That, and then people see that their children are living, and then they don't need to have more children. So.
Also, when they begin to see that education is the road to a better life, if you're looking for workers for your fields, the more the better. But if you're looking to need to educate your children, that's what cut the birth rate in this country. And there's some literature in this stuff in the Resource Center that indicates that that's sort of almost a given consequence of raising the general poverty level in societies, that the birth rate automatically begins to drop for just the reasons we were talking about. If you don't have to worry about infant mortality, if you don't have to worry about field workers in order to support you, the birth rate will drop. So I think that we can't focus on birth rate as necessarily a root problem, maybe more of a symptom than one of the basic problems.
I lived in Tanzania 3 years, and it was pretty amazing. When the government made a real commitment to the place of women in government and in society, women took it over themselves, and the matter of population control and health and feeding and a number of things, when they really grabbed a hold of this and they ran with it, it's amazing how strong the message got out in the country. It wasn't handed down from above some way. It was somehow it became an organizational agenda that women themselves implemented within the country, and some really excellent things. And then, of course, it was very obvious that as people made progress and they got out of the total dependence on agriculture and subsistence living, that they quickly saw it was into their advantage. This large number of children and all no longer was so much a requirement. One of the things that I mentioned that we really tried to push in our congregation was to live in solidarity with the poor, is to make a determined effort that when you vote not just in your own self-interest. I think most of us, that's the way we're trained to vote. What's good for me? We made a deliberate effort to say, if we are Christians and disciples in this congregation, when we go to the polls, we ought to ask, how do I vote for the powerless, the voiceless, that is, the poor, those that tend to not be in an influential position? They didn't make $10 contributions to politicians or $100 contributions or $100,000. They didn't belong to the $100,000 club that Bush had. How do you vote for the, on behalf of those people? And we felt we made some significant gains on helping our people look at issues, not in terms of what might be best for them. People that you know, have a good income, they have some investments. They look at the stock market to see how their stocks are doing. But if you can ask them, but if you're a disciple, but what are the issues out there? And will it be better for those 20-year-old blacks that live in our community that are 50% unemployed? That's the reality. If you're a black person in Los Angeles, at least half of you are unemployed, 18, 19, 20, 21. Well, is there any relationship to issues as they come up with the ballot to that issue? Tax matters, all kinds of things. And I found that my congregation, it was a middle class congregation all the way, it was pretty white, you know, but they recognize that the vote is a very important matter for us, but that's one way to express solidarity with the poor. And you can sell that to a lot of people.
Next year, they're not going to have any, you're not going to go to the polls to vote. You're going to be, just mail your vote in. So maybe the poor will vote more. I don't know.
It's, you know, I think it's really hard to identify the poor nowadays. I work in a public service setting, and we have a lot of people that are poor because they are mentally and emotionally disturbed.
They're out on the street.
They're mentally and emotionally disturbed. They're not just poor because they don't have access to a job because there's not a job there. They are, even if they had a job, they would still be poor. And I think it's very hard. It's become a much more complex issue to say, I am in solidarity with these human beings. I am, but there's other things there. I don't know how many of you are from Seattle, but right now there's a big push on to rid the Pioneer District of many of the people that hang around the park at the park down there. And two of the things they want to do to enforce this, so that these people who really have a lot of, I mean, they're troubled human beings, they have a lot of problems in their life, is that number one, they can't go around crapping and going to the bathroom all over the park. And number two, that they can't be seen drinking alcohol in public. Two things that I automatically would think we wouldn't want to have in a city that we lived in. But when they start cracking down on these two things, what they're doing is putting pressure on the poor or these people that are in that area, because this is just part of the way that they live. So, I mean, to me, this takes on a whole other... to have solidarity with these people becomes much, much more difficult.
And that's one place where finding a voice not on their behalf but from them is important. I think some of the biggest progress we've made in Minneapolis has been when people from that community have been worked with to become spokespersons for their organization. It's hard for me to speak for people like that. It's hard for me to know what they want or what would be helpful to them. You can set up a nice shelter with nice warm beds and whatnot, but if it doesn't meet their perceived needs, it's not going to do what you're asking it to do. And that's a very difficult thing. Some of these people have agendas that don't make much sense to us. But I think one of the things that we do have to do if we're going to be in a solid area is to let them speak for themselves, find out who they want.
There's that segment of the poor, that's a toughie. But I think there's a much larger segment, the working poor, or the poor that, you know, have the gifts, have the abilities, but just because of all kinds of reasons aren't able to make it. It isn't because they're mentally not capable, and it's not because they're lazy. It's because somehow they haven't been able in this system to make it work on their behalf.
But there is a large segment out there that is mentally ill or chemically dependent that we are not reaching at this point in time. We dismantled the structure that used to care for them in response to its abuses, but we left them with nothing.
That's right.
And I think that's an issue that we do have to address if we want to address justice.
And the only reason I bring it up is I think that we're seeing so many of these people. As I said, I'm in a public service setting in Seattle. And, you know, just in the last 5 or 6 years, the population that I see of poor people, it's so much more of that. So, you know, that tends to, I start thinking, gee, you know, am I getting old? Or why am I changing my attitude? And a lot of it has to do with the population that I see that's poor has changed. It's a much different population. It's not like the one you originally brought up long ago, this, but it's still talking about some really poor.
Let me take just 5 minutes and tell you what the topics I was going to deal under justice, seeking justice. One I was going to talk about, we all respond to the command to love. One definition of justice is love distributed. Love is very personal. It's usually kind of face to face. It's reaching those you can get to. Justice is dealing with beyond the reach of your personal loving concern and action. Justice is love distributed. And I believe the commandment that we're under, I think you can reduce almost all of them to, you know, love your neighbor, love your enemy. And justice is simply extending that without limitation. I was going to talk a little bit about the distinction between charity and justice. And I think usually when we talk about what Christian action is, it's very easy to talk about giving of charity and not extending justice. Charity is kind of treating the symptoms. Justice is dealing with the causes. Charity is charity is not controversial. In my congregation, I never had anybody object to gathering clothing, gathering food, helping somebody with hunger, or nobody ever objects to charity. When you talk about justice issues, stand by. It's most complex, it's difficult, it's controversial. Charity, often, you know, you do it, and you can do it. Charity is often dealing with sort of acts of God. They're emergency situations. There's something that nobody can, you know, nobody wanted it that way, but now you have to try to help. Justice usually deals with human-created problems. It's because the way the structures of our society work that injustice exists. It's because the rules of the game of living are usually written by the powerful. Congress responds to the pressure that's exerted on it, and that pressure is usually from those who have something to protect. In Seattle, they don't want them peeing on the streets because this is our property. It's our property. And frankly, the homeless don't see it as their property.
I think it's more than that, though. I'm sorry, I know I'm interrupting you, but I think it's more than that. I think that as a society, as a group of people, I don't want people in the bathroom when I'm going to a public place. I mean, I don't own that property. But I think that this is something that I think that we see as a given in our society. It's no longer a given, because when we start coming down on these people that don't own this property and feel this way, we are hassling them, or we're disenfranchising them in some way. And I'm sorry, I just wanted to...
Well, I hear that, and I agree. Yeah. I don't like
it. It wasn't a private property issue more than the reason I brought it up.
Yeah, but I want it nice and clean when I walk down there, and I'm used to nice, clean things. Mm-hmm.
I find it terrible that these people, there's no bathrooms provided. Right. Like in Europe, any city you go, there's public bathrooms anywhere.
Yeah.
But here, what are they supposed to do?
They're not allowed in public restaurants.
They can't go to the department store.
They can't go to a bar unless they buy a drink.
Yeah.
So, and why don't the cities that put in chemical toilets in them, or do like they do in European countries? France, I mean, in Paris, you go, or London even. You go 2 blocks and you have public lavatories.
But the taxation is another.
If they leave them open in Seattle, they get trashed.
Yeah.
I'm convinced that you can measure a society by how the restrooms are treated. The public restrooms. I mean, consistently, you know, places I've gone, in places where the public restrooms are atrocious, you have rather atrocious societies. You have real basic problems if you can't keep open a restroom without having it trashed. And that's the basic problem. And, well, there's other problems too. There's budgetary problems, there's homosexual problems, things like that, which unfortunately seem to direct themselves towards public restrooms. And if you live close in Seattle or near Green Lake, you know what I mean.
In New York City, the French corporation was manufactured public lavatories to be placed in strategic places in New York City. And this was voted down because the handicap said you've got to make them big enough so we can get our wheelchairs in there. And there were two objections to that. Number one, it would take up too much room and cost too much money. In the second place, people would go in there and sleep and do all kinds of desultory things. So that was outlawed. Now there you have a group of people who bring pressure. And it's unfortunate because we want to help the handicapped, but then all these vast numbers of people who could be benefited who aren't handicapped that use these public facilities. So
just a way to get out of it.
But the handicapped have brought pressure, and so the fathers and babies, the legislators said, well, we can't do it because they're handicapped. Everything has to be adaptable for handicapped. No, it wasn't a practical solution.
But that's the selfishness of a small group.
Yeah.
I saw that documentary.
How many handicaps would be downtown?
Well, I read about it in the paper.
I don't think I'd want to say it's the selfishness of that small group, because they have just been working for some kind of recognition of the rights of the handicapped, and they just won some victories. And now, there are problems that come about because of that. But my guess is that's not the only reason that thing failed.
Yeah.
That sure was key to it. But
it came down to a matter of bureaucracy. There's just so much. They listed every agency, every city government agency in New York that would have to clear it. And there's just a whole slew of them. Of course, they interviewed hundreds of people on the streets, they couldn't find a single person that didn't think it was a fabulous idea. And you like drop a quarter in it and use the bathroom. It's virtually indestructible.
Self-cleansing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, it came down more to bureaucracy than anything else. But the arguments of the handicapped spokesman were rather irrational.
I agree with that.
You got interrupted your thought. I hope you can pull it back.
Well, I wanted to get on and just let this to be a free-for-all tonight, rather something new. Our time is about up. I guess my basic concern in this session, these sessions, has been to raise discipleship from a more personalistic and rather spiritualized and privatized expression of what it means to be a disciple, and try to make it more of a social expression that deals with some of the not one-to-one relationships in life, but rather to the issues of living in a mass society, urban society, the kind of world increasingly we live in. My father, who was raised on a farm, used to tell me about, you know, what Christians did there. And it was also individualistic and personal. And somebody had need, all the people got together and raised food for them and build them a house. Somebody's house burned down, they'd come and work and put it together.
There was no money involved, hardly. No, hardly any money involved.
It was fun. Unfortunately, in Seattle today, or in Los Angeles, it just doesn't work that way. And we haven't yet found how to make it work.
But that's where organizations like Habitat for Humanity are bringing some of that back in.
Fantastic program. We also haven't learned how to deal, you know, we say, but somehow we, you know, the cost of providing toilets in the inner city. Well, but you see, alongside of that, in my area, California, prices of housing are outrageous. But today, there's still a pretty good market for houses that are $750,000, $1 million in South Orange County. Hey, they're preserved their value pretty well. And houses that are $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 are, you know, that's not at all uncommon. The average home in all Orange County is probably $200,000. And to say, we've got a real problem here. We can't afford toilets when the great majority of people are living at a totally different level. Obviously, we haven't figured out how to really make us a more of an egalitarian society. And I know people who live in these pretty well circumstances, and it's not that they're that much smarter, and it's not that they're that much finer people, and they have high values and work hard and all. Because I know a lot of the others out there that are, you know, among the working poor. I find they're very resourceful and hardworking and all. I often think, I have three children. It happens, they all graduated from high school, they didn't drop out. They all went on to college. One's an engineer, one's a teacher, one's a lawyer. And tell you the truth, they would have either had to be stupid not to have been successful, or they would have had really been rebellious, that they would have, if they just kind of went along to what they were encouraged. They had an example in their family. They've always been part of, you know, churches, or when we were in East Africa, they were surrounded by, you know, elite people in university settings and so on. And in a sense, by just kind of following the flow, they're very successful. I'm proud of them. They could have, they didn't have to turn. But when I compare that to a family, you know, maybe a single parent with three kids living in an inner city ghetto situation who's working, making $7 an hour. I recently led a strike of people against our California Lutheran Hospital and the convalescence home. There was a woman who was an assistant cook. She had worked for them 27 years, and she was making $7.85 an hour. That kind of thing. But people under those conditions, boy, for those kids to make it up and be successful, once in a while, one will do it, you know? But that's kind of unusual. All the conditions that come to play are more likely to squeeze out the drive and the incentive and all. I think that when I say living in solidarity with the poor, it means to try to create the kind of conditions where there are reasonable hopes that under the societal conditions that exist, that those three kids can have just about the same opportunity that my three kids had. I think that's the vision of what the kingdom of God is all about, that tugs on us and which we're called to be his disciples.